How do you have that conversation internally about finding use cases where AI can add value or augment what investment advisors are doing without feeling the role of the investment advisor is threatened?
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance to me in my head. There are areas of the investment lifecycle and process that can benefit from tools like this, and specifically getting more information in the hands of people who make decisions and make assessments.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. We recently welcomed our 1 millionth listener to this community. Thanks, as always, for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. As always, I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. We learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show. And of course, the added bonus, you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's AI fun fact. Jonathan Kemper writes in The Decoder that responsible AI now has an ISO standard that describes how AI should be implemented by developers. ISO 42001 is the world's first standard for AI management, and it's intended to provide useful guidance to address ethical considerations, transparency, and continuous learning. It's intended to provide a structured way to balance AI risks and opportunities. Kemper goes on to write, with the increasing use of AI in all areas, there's also growing concern about the potential damage it can cause if developers of LLMs don't incorporate appropriate guardrails. Now, my commentary, this is a huge leap forward in, we'll say, meandering conversations about AI governance. The International Organization for Standardization, ISO, is a respected nonpartisan global body that's already trusted to regulate everything from the power grid to warehouse safety. AWS from Amazon has already adopted the new AI ISO standard. I hope everyone else in the AI community follows suit. As always, we'll link to the full article in today's show notes. Now, shifting to this week's conversation. Chris Herringshaw is Chief Technology Officer at Janus Henderson Investors. He's responsible for all aspects of the company's technology and is a member of the Janus Henderson Executive Committee. Previously, Chris spent more than 15 years at Citadel Investment Group, most recently as Managing Director of Global Infrastructure Technology. Before that, he founded Quova, now a part of Neustar, the IP Intelligence Division. And Chris also served as Vice President of Engineering there and later as their CTO. Chris holds a BS degree in computer systems engineering from the college football national champion, University of Michigan. Go Big Blue. He serves on the engineering advisory board at the University of Michigan College of Engineering and is a member of the Institutional Investor Financial Technology Forum. Chris and I met at a CIO event in Denver, where he charmed the crowd with his combination of wit and wisdom. I knew that I wanted to introduce him to this community. And without further ado, Chris, it's my pleasure to welcome you to AI and the Future of Work. Let's get started by having you share a bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Dan, thank you so much. And thank you for that wonderful intro. It's been quite a week for us in the Michigan alumni family. We're incredibly excited. So yeah, to talk a little bit about me and my background. So, you know, currently the Chief Technology Officer at Janus Henderson Investors, and it's been an interesting journey to get here for me. Going way back, I'm that computer cliche a little bit, right? So one of my friends and their family had Tandy computer way back in the day, and with the floppy disks and everything else. And so that was my first intro, and then the Commodore 64, and then programming and Bard's Tale and all those sorts of things. And this is all, you know, pre-university for me. And then when I went into university, it was pretty obvious I had a love of computing and computers and programming and creating something that didn't exist. And like my two hands went in there and typed some lines on that keyboard and out came something interesting. And so I followed that path at the University of Michigan and got my engineering degree, both in software and computer systems design, which is a blended hardware software kind of degree. And when I came out, I went straight into entrepreneurship and venture-backed high-tech startups. We did some in Boston and Silicon Valley and New York. And coming out, it had that young idealistic attitude of, hey, I'm not working for the man, I'm going to work for myself. And, you know, a group of friends and I, both at Michigan and MIT, got together and started a number of companies. And you learn so much doing that. And I'm sure your audience has been through that as well, because you need to not only just exercise your technical skills, but you need to deal a little bit of sales and a little bit of marketing and a little bit of raising money and writing presentations for important people. So you're just forced to learn so many of those skills, which has become so valuable for me later in my career. So about the first half of my career, I was an entrepreneur. And then while I was on hiatus and working on the pitch for my next company with some friends of mine, I needed something to do. My mind was a little bit stagnant and I wanted to make sure I stayed hands-on in tech. And I somewhat stumbled into financial services. And I got with an amazing hedge fund company called Citadel Investment Group. And there they do such advanced technology work that I was constantly challenged. And what went from, hey, I'll just do this for a year until I raise more money, turned into, I'll do it for 2 years, I'll do it for 5 years, I'll do it for 10, and so on and so forth. And then I made a transition from hedge funds to asset management. And, you know, for me, that was, I think, a mental shift from what can we do now to how can we really create longer term programs of value and do, you know, bigger things that take longer to do and maybe move markets in a different way than the hedge funds do. And the entire time I've been in technology roles and in roles that are primarily centered around engineering and solving really hard problems. And that's what led me to where I am today.
So Janus Henderson being a financial services firm is not the first industry that you think of when you think about being technology driven. But oftentimes, at least in Silicon Valley, you know, we say every company is now a tech company. Talk to us about the role of technology at what some might think is a legacy financial services firm.
Sure. That's a great question. So I think the reality is every financial services firm this day and age is a technology company. I can't think of one that, you know, primarily operates with manual processing and that isn't working on big data or artificial intelligence or automation or client experience. They're all doing it to some degree because it provides competitive advantage. It provides better outcomes for our clients. So you know, we're heavily invested in that. And my team likes to say we're a technology company that also provides financial services. I think my colleagues in the investment side would say differently. But, you know, it's a great partnership to make sure that we're able to use advanced technology to make their roles better, to make their decision-making better, and ultimately make the outcomes for our clients better.
Financial services companies are notorious for being risk-averse. And yet, here we are talking about AI and the future of work. I can only imagine some of the discussions you have with the executive committee about how and where AI might be a good fit, given just the public's perception of both the opportunities as well as the risks. How do you get the exec committee comfortable with the use of potentially more AI to get the benefits from AI, but while still mitigating the, you know, potential risks for a financial services company?
Yeah, great question. So, and we have had a lot of discussions with my executive peers, and it's taken a little bit of time. It's taken a lot of education. It's taken some hands-on. Because, you know, it's one thing to think about a technology concept in abstract, right? And how scary it might be and how disruptive it might be. It's another, once you really get your hands on it and start to use it and start to see, oh, okay, it's not nearly as bad as I thought. And no, I can't take that bad action or negative action like I had feared I would be able to. And so, you know, for me, it's been standing up versions of the tools that protect our intellectual property, that are within the confines of our walls from a technology perspective, and then just putting it in their hands, not to change their roles or to do their job functions, but just to try and to experiment with in a sort of a non-lethal way, if you will. And, you know, once they had done that, they started to see the light. Okay, this is a great productivity enhancer. You know, it doesn't do this critical thing that we need a human being to make a decision on, but boy, it sure helps put more information and paint a broader context to hopefully make a better decision. You know, so to that end, for us, we've stood up a number of tools internally, including generative AI tools, specifically ChatGPT, but ones that are isolated and within our four walls. And that gives us a level of comfort that at least, you know, confidential information and questions and things like that that are asked of these tools are not making their way outside of our walls. So that's step number one. Step number two, we put together a committee that was going to assess the opportunity and the risk reward for using tools like this in any given scenario, right? We're a heavy regulated industry and we're a heavily regulated company, and we need to be incredibly careful with our obligations around confidentiality, client information, and things like that. At the same time, those clients want us to be able to take advantage of advanced technology to produce better outcomes for them. You know, so for us, it was about transparency. It was about getting hands-on. It was about really like openly talking about what the fears were and then having enough comfort that we could produce solutions that were going to solve for those needs while still allowing the advancement of these areas of technology within the firm.
The elephant in the room is that many would think that AI could pose an existential threat to the investment advisory business. How do you have that conversation internally about finding use cases where AI can add value or augment what investment advisors are doing without feeling like investment the role of the investment advisor is threatened?
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance to me in my head, right? So there are areas of the investment lifecycle and process that can benefit from tools like this, and specifically getting more information in the hands of people who make decisions and make assessments. And there are certainly areas that are ripe for more automated styles of trading that have less sort of nuance to them. You know, but to us, you know, we think about it like this. So if you ask, let's say you ask your mother, or let's say she asks you, how was your day, Dan? And your boss or your colleague asks you, how was your day, Dan? Those are two different contexts that produce different kinds of answers, right? And if you go ask a generative AI tool, you know, what's my trust level or how was your day? Or one of those questions that really requires a human nuance, it gives you a deflective answer saying, you know, those are individualized decisions and it depends on multiple factors and things like that, which don't actually help you get to a resolution. And so inherently, there are areas of investing that require some human nuance. How much do you trust an executive team to deliver on their objectives? Do you inherently trust them? You've heard the pitch, you've asked them questions, you've talked to them. Do I trust them or not? Is a big part of some of the investment lifecycle. And there's no tools today that can help make that decision. They can help inform it. They can help give you more information about it. But it really comes down to that human-to-human interaction in a lot of cases. So we see it as an incredible complement to our investment lifecycle. Will it replace some of our decision-making? Sure. Over time, it probably will in areas that are a little bit more analytic-driven. But inherently, you know, markets are moved by a lot of human sentiment and what is going on and how companies are perceived. And it's difficult today for the iteration of technology that we have to completely replace that.
To make it real, talk me through a few of the use cases where your clients, either investment advisors or potentially retail investors, what are they asking for with regard to AI and more technology built on the Janus Henderson platform?
Yeah. So what they're asking for from us really is more insights, right? Help them understand what's going on a little better. And so to do that, it requires us to broaden the scope of what we're looking at and looking at to produce insights and analysis and, you know, find, you know, the needle in the haystack in some cases. And so translating that to a real world use case, that means we want to be looking at more data, larger sets of data. And since a lot of these analysis and decisions require that human nuance, there's a limitation about how quickly someone can consume and put together all that information to be able to perform an analysis. So for us, you know, putting these tools out to our research advisors and our investment analysts to be able to summarize large documents, to be able to look across industries and you know, compare different companies that, you know, would require normally hours and hours of research, that can be done in a much shorter period of time to produce information and context for them to be able to have something interesting to say from an investment perspective. And so we're really using that to again, augment our teams and maybe mechanically increase the scope of what they can see and what they can consume to produce those better insights for our clients. they're also asking us for what else should they be doing, right? The markets have been pretty up and down for a while, and there are periods of high volatility and stagnation. And, you know, our clients want to know what other ideas are out there for us to be working on and to think about and to orient our portfolios towards. And again, it comes down to increasing the field of view about what our investment professionals can see about the markets, about, you know, what's going on with companies and industries and sectors, and pulling that information together and helping them make more informed analysis and better recommendations and options for our clients.
I got to ask, in a heavily regulated industry like yours, I assume you're regulated by the SEC, potentially among other agencies.
Absolutely.
And a lot of what you have to be prepared for is being able to defend decisions that have been made and create and provide a paper trail. And, you know, presumably that's just part of standard quarterly reporting. What happens if some of these decisions are automated, potentially using AI, and maybe the AI has a really hard time explaining itself or documenting its reasoning like a human would? What does that mean in terms of regulation? Does the regulation need to catch up to the business process, or does the business process need to somehow adapt itself in this world where decisions might not be as traceable?
Yeah, I mean, classically, it's usually regulation chasing business process, right? And I think that's the case here as well. We are highly regulated by a number of different agencies, and we are in discussions with them already about what does it mean and how are they thinking about it? How are we thinking about it? How is it going to affect, similar to your earlier question, how does it affect the investment process for us, so they can think about where should the boundaries be and what kind of safety net should we put around it? We spent a lot of time talking about that at Janus Henderson. And you know, I think what's become pretty clear is there's not enough transparency in the tools today to fully understand how decisions are made to a level that might satisfy some of that regulation, which is why we have such a productivity enhancing viewpoint on how we want to use these tools. So if I can put more data, more information, some analysis, some insights, some summarization in front of a professional investment manager, and the professional investment manager makes the decision, then we've got the trail backwards. And when we look at a piece of that puzzle, and if a piece of that puzzle was given to them by an AI or a machine learning tool, that's one input amongst a number of inputs, right? That includes their own research, you know, their own interactions with a particular company or a sector. And when you put that together, that pretty much mimics what we do today, right? We take in a lot of research today, and some of it ends up being non-factual, especially if you grab it off of, you know, the internet, or you're looking for sentiment analysis. I mean, those things are either guesses or they are not known to be golden sources of data, but sometimes they are right. Often they are right. And you want to make that a part of your decision-making process. And so for us, these tools become a part of that decision-making process. And we're very open about that when we do it. And you know, so far, that seems to be the logical and I think reasonable path forward versus making completely automated decisions and then not understanding the nuance of things like how was the model trained and what input went into it, what context was set when you did the training, which, as you know, they affect the quality and the precision and the fidelity of the answers that come out when you start asking it questions.
I imagine there's going to be a lot of litigation up ahead from end customers or retail investors who feel like, you know, algorithms gone rogue made poor decisions that, you know, that were associated with significant, you know, decrease in the value of their holdings. What's your sense of who's responsible if an algorithm makes a bad decision and, you know, and the retail investor wants to hold someone accountable?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, we are responsible. So us as Janus Henderson would be responsible for, you know, the use of artificial intelligence and machine learning and how far that goes into the investment process. We need to have the controls in place to make sure that we understand all the things we just talked about in terms of the training and the context and the scope and how we ask the questions, which makes a difference. But equally, investing is a risk-based decision, right? And you take varying levels of risk based on the kind of trading and the kind of asset you want to invest in. And I think, you know, our products and services are going to reflect that spectrum of risk. And the key is being transparent about what we are doing. And if you want to have a fund that or a product that is entirely traded by artificial intelligence and machine learning, you've got to be incredibly straightforward that, hey, Dan, we're not making human decisions here. Things will go wrong, and we may not be able to explain every decision because this is the state of the technology we're using to drive that product. But you need to know all that when you invest in this kind of product. It can't be something that we try and gloss over as an industry or, you know, allow to creep too far into that process without being incredibly transparent about how we're using it.
Curious to get your take on this. As a retail investor, I feel like gone are the days when I should trade based on any information that I get, you know, from 10Ks or CNBC or the traditional sources, because the algorithms are always going to be many steps ahead. And by the time I learn about it, I may have a thesis that's based on some data, but my data is always going to be stale and the algorithms are always going to make better informed decisions because they have complete access, perfect memory, you know, access to the sum total of the world's knowledge about that thing, that industry, that stock that I might be interested in trading. Is it the case that we're rapidly approaching just, you know, the end of the era where retail or even institutional investors can make decisions that ever could be better than what algorithms can do?
No, I don't think we're close to reaching that precipice yet with the technology as we know it and the industry as we know it. As your audience knows, artificial intelligence algorithms have been around for many decades, and yet here we are. We are still trading the way we are, and technology continues to evolve and influence that cycle and change how the markets work and how the industry works, but we're still here. We're still making decisions, and we still have humans that are executing the nuance of what's going on and making a real-world assessment of that artificial intelligence just can't do. For decisions, again, that are more factual and driven by data, number of units sold here equals generally an increase in stock price there, sure, like algorithms are going to dominate that particular segment of the market because we just can't go fast enough in making those decisions versus a computer. But when you look at it and you say, hey, there's a new Pokemon game coming out, and what impact is that really going to have on video game sales in the electronics industry? You know, an algorithm is not going to have any idea what the appeal is going to be of that Pokemon game, right? And that's a judgment call, right? And so, you know, maybe we look at it and say, what's the uptake among kids and what's the sentiment online and how much are they talking about it? You know, what are my own kids saying? What are they saying when they come home from school? Is there buzz about it? Is there not buzz about it? Those are things that remain out of the reach of being able to put into any sort of algorithmic computation that really do move markets. And that perception, that sentiment moves markets. And sometimes markets move for irrational reasons, right? You remember the whole GameStop thing that happened a while ago. I mean, that was completely irrational against any traditional investment theory, but yet that's what the markets did. And it was a highly disruptive factor for a number of people within the markets. And you know, you can't really account for that programmatically or data-wise, right? That was a you know, something that was initiated by humans, affected by humans, and our sort of intellect and nuance that we just can't replicate today.
It's a good point that looking at historical patterns in the data is not sufficient when it comes to markets, like you mentioned, whether it's video games or anything else, where markets get disrupted by new patterns being introduced. And I think that you make a good point that algorithms can never capture sentiment or trends. You know, the algorithms aren't attending CES. They're not, you know, they're not in the R&D labs, things like that.
And that's where humans are, right? We have conversations with companies that are developing new technologies just to get a sense of what they're thinking about. And if you were to go ask ChatGPT, what's the next technology disruption that's going to affect the financial markets? It doesn't know. I know because we've tried to ask it, and it doesn't give you an answer that helps in any way, shape, or form. But us being out there and hearing people and believing their belief in the technology that they're working on in the R&D labs and in some of these companies affects how we make investment decisions today before any data is even available for an algorithm to see.
All right, Chris. So you're talking to a big audience of entrepreneurs who are looking to sell into financial services companies, and they're here listening to wisdom from the CTO of a publicly traded financial services firm. What are you buying? Where's the room to innovate that you feel like, you know, if that product knocked on your door, you buy it today?
Yeah, great question. So obviously, I'll give the obvious answer, data, and helping manage large sets of data, curate it, understand it, you know, gain some level of insight or normalization that would then help us determine, where do we want to apply machine learning, or where do we want to have a more sophisticated AI algorithm take place? Because, you know, like many parts of technology, bad data in means bad data out. And so we've got to be able to feed the models that we develop with really good data that is structured in the right way. Because, you know, context matters in all these tools. And, you know, if you tell it something like, you know, communism is an amazing way of managing your and governing your people and capitalism is garbage, that model's going to use that context to formulate all of its answers. And to us, that's nonsense. We don't believe in that. But that's a context, right? So you got to get the context right about the data and then have the data be of high quality. So for us, anything in that realm of how we can make our data better, more structured, have the right kind of insights into it to help not only determine the models we want to build, but then also feed them in the way that we need to get the decisions out of it that we want, that's phenomenal for us. You know, I would say that uses of these kinds of technologies in vendor products to free up time from my staff is certainly a winner and worth a look. So for example, if I can get, you know, 10%, let's say, time back out of my 500 person plus organization, that's a huge amount of time that I can use towards solving a higher order business problem. So where are those areas that still exist today that are not quite big enough that they need like an automation solution, but we need to make people more productive in what they're doing? And, you know, I'm excited about things like the idea of Microsoft Copilot coming in and for me personally doing things like, hey, summarize what I missed when I was on a plane for 12 hours. What did I miss in my inbox? What do I need to be looking at and what do I need to know? And, you know, the promise of a tool like that is it will give me those insights. And so if we can take that concept and apply it across a lot of our vendor tools and save us time in the tools or save us, effort that we're putting in to manage and maintaining the tools, that's gold as well. So for existing vendors to really help us be more efficient as an organization, frees up capital that I can put into more advanced technology. You know, that's another area. You know, things that produce better insight for our clients who are obviously financial services related, retail, institutional investors, things like what's a more interesting way to view data? So visualizations and dashboarding, as you know, old as that technology sector is, there's a lot of new ways of thinking about data and visualizing it and, you know, helping us see what that is and then applying that to our use case. Those are areas that we're taking a lot of look at right now as well. And then obviously, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention cybersecurity underpinning all of this. There's the more we rely on outside data, the more we rely on algorithms, the more we rely on different areas that different vendors, maybe even from a SaaS perspective, that are outside of our walls, it raises the risk level. And we need to be able to mitigate that risk and control it being in a highly regulated business. So it's less about, you know, information security like penetration from that perspective. And it's more about where's the data going and how is it being used and do I have visibility into it and assurances that it's used for, you know, this use case and not that use case. You know, those are things that make a real difference to us in financial services.
Entrepreneurs listening, there you go. You're welcome on behalf of Chris. You just got your product real good perspective. And Chris, so from your vantage point, I imagine you get inundated with vendor pitches. Polish your crystal ball. What's one maybe non-obvious or maybe even controversial prediction that you have for where AI is headed in the next, call it 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, I've said this and it's been pretty controversial, is when I look at artificial intelligence today, even with the advent of ChatGPT, I don't think it's particularly intelligent, right? This is technology that has been around in some way, shape, or form for 30, 40 years at this point. And, you know, what's really happened in recent years is we've had compute power that has gone up exponentially. which allows us to create more complex models that take in larger sets of data alongside, you know, the obvious, you know, multi-exponential growth of the internet and then the knowledge base available there. So you hook it together and it's doing more interesting things, absolutely. And it's got more use cases that are applicable to where we are today as a society, but it still doesn't solve a lot of the really hard problems. And so, you know, when I get pitches from vendors and it's, you know, we're going to completely change the way your business works, like I don't believe it. Off the bat, it's hard to accept that at face value, knowing what I know about the technology. Now, vendors who come in and say, hey, we can help you with this process by, you know, putting more information in front of your people, by, you know, helping them craft things that they can then review and then forward on, or, you know, something that increases the productivity. Maybe it's, you know, automated code generation, which has gotten, you know, much better with the current generation of tools. You know, things like that's interesting, that's believable, that is certainly something that we're taking a look at in the very short term, versus having to really be convinced that my entire operating model is going to change because of this iteration of the technology.
I have to have you back and we'll see how that prediction did.
Absolutely.
Chris, we're about out of time, but I'm not letting you off the hot seat without answering one last question for me.
Okay, go for it.
You went through your background and, you know, as I get to know you, it's hard to know if you're an entrepreneur first, a technologist first, a programmer, a tinkerer, a CTO. What's your advice to the kid who graduated from University of Michigan, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and started Quova, and then, you know, went to Citadel, Janus Henderson, et cetera. But what would you teach that kid who's just coming out of college?
Great question. I think the first thing I would tell that young, very arrogant kid for no particular good reason is, listen, sport, you don't know nearly as much as you think. And so, you know, the areas where I've struggled in my career are, you know, when I got to a point where I got this, I understand all of this, and you reflexively stop learning, stop being curious. And so, you know, I would tell that kid, you know, be humble and you don't know nearly as much as you think you do. Keep learning, keep focusing on learning. You know, that's helped me tremendously in the latter half of my career. You know, I'm constantly talking to people, visiting people, reading stuff. Fundamentally, I am a tinkerer. I am an engineer at heart. I'm the kid who took apart all of his toys growing up, you know, much to my parents' chagrin, took them apart because I want to understand how it worked, and then put them back together in new, probably different and somewhat Frankensteinian ways. But I'm always looking to build something and to solve a problem with what I find fascinating, which is the entire realm of technology. Another piece of advice I would give to that young kid is keep asking for help. Ask for help, ask for mentorship, you know, because again, you don't know nearly as much as you think. And there's a whole world out there beyond what you think you can see and touch. And, you know, pushing to get access to it, whether it's by people or by experience, or, you know, pick up a book and learn a different programming language used for a much different, you know, part of the global commerce system than you're used to, is valuable. You'll see why some of these other languages are, you know, more appropriate in certain circumstances, and maybe, you know, easier, better, more transparent, and maybe just better for that particular use case because they have more inherent functionality in them. You know, these are all things that can really help translate across industry. I mean, how many times have you heard that, right? Bringing an idea or a concept from one line of business to another, one industry to another, like changes how people think in that other new line of business, right? Oh, I never thought about the world that way. I never thought about solving the problem in that manner, be it, you know, hardware, software, process, you know, whatever. They just haven't thought about it because they haven't been exposed to it. And the more I just focus on that in my career, even to this day, the better off the outcomes tend to be. The more insights we have, the more innovation we have. And that only benefits us as an investment firm, and it benefits our clients.
Brilliant answer. One of the things that I believe distinguishes us from the machines is that we can always be curious. We can always continue on that learning journey, and we can always be humbled by the fact that there's always more to learn, more growth to do. So whether it's, you know, the kid coming out of college or you and I, you know, who are in the middle of our careers, you know, there's just always that opportunity for personal growth.
100%.
Hey, Chris, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you coming in and hanging out. If the audience wants to connect with you or learn more about the great work you're doing, where should they go?
Yeah, certainly. You can visit us at janicehenderson.com, one word, or you can email me directly, chris.herringshaw@janicehenderson.com. And you can also reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Great work, Chris. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I had a great time today.
You bet. That's a wrap for this week on AI and the future of work. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain. And of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.